I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode.
When you look at how do you create alpha, you have to either believe you can just buy better than other people, or you have to believe you read cycles better than other people, or you have to believe you operate real estate better than other people, or that you're better off at sector rotation than other people. There are, you know, different ways to differentiate yourself, but it's not like in the 80s when just having capital was already a differentiator.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Randy Rowe, chairman and founder of Green Court Partners. We discuss Randy's career, including the time he spent working for the legendary real estate investor Sam Zell, and the institutionalization of niche real estate sectors and the role that they play in a real estate portfolio. If you've ever been curious about near airport parking, manufactured housing, seniors housing, or industrial outdoor storage, this episode's for you. Let's get into it. Welcome to the show, Randy.
Hey, thank you, Brandon.
It's great to see you. It's been a long time. Can you spend a moment for our guests who don't already know you? Just introduce yourself, your company, give us a brief background.
I'm Randy Rowe. I am chairman of Green Court Partners. Founded the business 22 years ago. But before that, first went to business school, then to law school, practiced law for 4 years with a firm in Chicago that had a little teeny client called the FSLIC. And while I was there, it exploded with all the 81, 82 takeovers of SNLs. So I had a chance to do a lot of real estate workouts, which I view as a great education and a lot of the things not to do. Then got recruited by Goldman Sachs to come into real estate investment banking, running the Midwest region. I had been a research assistant in business school and written a case about a merger that the partner at Goldman handled, and then he moved to head up real estate. That was Ken Brody. And so he asked if I wanted to, you know, leave law and move into investment banking. And when I heard about the exciting things they were doing, I decided to do it. And so moved over and did lots of large sales and large financings and trophy assets. That was a lot of fun. And then one of my clients was Sam Zell. And Sam kept saying, if I was smart, I would give up investment banking and join him. He said the fact that it took me 4 years to say yes proves I'm not very smart. You know, he passed away a year. I still miss him. And went and joined Sam during the Zell Merrill Lynch funds. And that was a lot of fun buying distressed real estate and fixing it. In 1995, decided to branch out on my own, along with my partner, Steve Quazzo. We founded what was then Transwestern Investment Company in a partnership with Transwestern Commercial Services, and did that for probably six, 7 years. But then um, There was a desire at Transwestern by the broader partnership to buy more trophy assets and to move in that direction. And I felt the markets were healing, and I thought there was going to be more opportunity in what we referred to as niche strategies then. So I left to start Green Court Partners, and we've been for 22 years focused on niche, now often referred to as alternative asset classes, building businesses. At the moment, our main activities are we tend to pick three or four things to work on at a time. We're active in the near airport parking space through the parking spot, which we bought from the Pritzkers back in 2011. We're active in the manufactured housing space through a company called Windward Communities, both senior and family. We're active in senior housing, both independent living and active adult. And we're active in industrial outdoor storage with a primary focus on truck storage. So those are our four primary strategies today.
Wow. That's a lot that you just rattled off in 3 minutes. I think, you know, with 40 years-ish of professional experience. So going back to the early days, you kind of glossed over it, but it sounds like you went to business school. I think I heard you practiced law before you became an investment banker. Kind of what was the intention in the moment, if you can recall, when you, you know, first went to business school? What were you hoping to accomplish? And, you know, I'm trying to figure out kind of where did your journey into business building, real estate begin?
Well, as a kid, I was always very entrepreneurial. I did a lot of things that, you know, in retrospect, were different than a lot of other kids. You know, in the summer, I used to gather up gardener stakes, and then they'd have babies, and I'd sell them to all the neighborhood kids. You can imagine I was really popular with some of the other mothers. I, you know, used to do a lot of shoveling of snow and cutting of lawns and all that. Then in college, I booked a lot of live entertainment. I found that there was a need for fraternity bands and for concerts and other things. And I built enough of a network to be able to do that. And it was also a good way to create an interesting social life because I had to go check on those venues and things. So it was always an inexpensive way to date. You know, and I put together a service to deliver hometown newspapers on campus so people get their hometown newspapers. And, you know, I just found that in business school, four of us ran a resume service so people could have fancy looking resumes when they applied for jobs. I just always enjoyed creating businesses. But in business school, the class that really caught my attention was Bill Porvoo's class on real estate. And so it really got me interested in real estate, but I'd always wanted to do both degrees. I tried to do the joint degree, and I found that I gave up too many of the electives on the business side. When you did 1.5 years of business school and 2.5 of law, the extra half a year of business school were a lot of the classes I cared about the most. So I decided to do them separately. And so turned it into a 5-year program, but in law school, got to take a lot of real property classes and tax classes so that I could think through some of the tax consequences of some of the structures. And all that was very interesting. And I thought, coming out of law school, I needed to practice law if I was going to really cement it because, you know, law school is kind of theoretical. It's a lot of high and mighty discussions about, you know, was this case decided correctly or incorrectly and why, and there's often not a correct answer. And it's not a lot of applied law. You're not actually seeing deals being put together and structuring them. And so my initial thought was to go practice law. I was very interested in what I was doing because of all the FSLIC work. There was no RTC at the time. So the lawyer was both the lawyer and the business person. And so for me, that was a lot of fun to be both the client and the lawyer. And so they would give you a portfolio of troubled loans, they'd say, go fix them. And so you would dig into the issues. And I'll say one of the interesting things is back then people thought there was, you know, a lot of fraud and a lot of bad stuff going on. And I'll tell you that it was just a lot of bad policy. When we went and we deregulated interest rates and allowed the banks to compete with the money market funds, in the process, we told them, well, fine, now go make commercial loans and you'll make a lot more money and you'll be good. Well, none of these banks had any experience doing commercial loans. And so they were doing a lot of what we referred to as ADC loans, acquisition, development, construction loans, which had embedded in them the interest reserves so they couldn't go into default for 3 or 4 years. So you'd hit these cliffs where suddenly you had very troubled assets. But I enjoyed doing that. And but for the fact that one of my good friends who worked at Goldman, Barry Sholem, reached out to me and said, you know, next time you're in New York, would you come talk to us? And I was in New York closing a deal. Back then, it was a chemical bank, which was around. It was a chemical bank loan. And I went over there, and then I started hearing about, you know, they were branching into the capital markets. They were doing, you know, commercial paper programs with swaps, and they were doing international flows of capital out of the Middle East and out of Japan. And, you know, it just was a lot more worldly than what I was doing, fixing broken subdivisions in Peoria. So it looked pretty interesting. So I decided to make the jump. And at that time, Goldman Sachs had a massive market share of deals over 50 million. So we were literally in the middle of all the large and interesting transactions. So I was enjoying it a lot. And then, as I mentioned, Sam kept tugging my chain saying, you know, don't you want to be a principal? Don't you want to be the client? And I did. So eventually I made the change. And Goldman was great about it. They said, you're not going to a competitor and you're going to a client. And, you know, we're very supportive of that. So there was no bad blood there. And with Sam, it was exciting because that's, you know, that he had raised the first opportunity fund, the Zelle Merrill Lynch fund series. And so he and I were our representatives, and Merrill Lynch had two of their representatives, and we went out and bought a lot of real estate at big discounts to replacement costs. So it was an exciting time.
What was it like working for Sam Zell?
You know, I'm very appreciative of having worked for Sam, because when he brought me in to run all of his real estate, I was, you know, 35 years old, and I didn't know. I told him at the time, I said, why are you convinced I can do this, given that I've only been an investment banker? I haven't been a principal. And he said, I know you can do it. And he believed in me. And so I did it. And he was a high energy, fast pace, very creative, not scared of making decisions at all. You know, he felt that if he made a bad decision, he'd make another one tomorrow to correct it. He had some really core beliefs about looking at discounts to replacement cost, because in a low barrier market, your only protection really was the extent that you had a better basis. In a higher barrier market, he was less sensitive to that because the barrier was to creating more product in a high barrier market. He was very able to, when something did not work as expected, it didn't cloud his judgment on the next deal. He was able to compartmentalize that, make sure we focused on getting it fixed, but that it didn't change his ability to make the incremental decision to do another one. And so, you know, really in that respect, a great contrarian investor, because he was more excited when everybody else was running the other direction, when he got very excited. So much of my philosophy about how to price risk goes back to those days, because I thought Sam really had some very solid fundamental building blocks upon which he made those types of decisions. You know, it was an exciting time. There was, back then, having money was a big deal. I mean, having capital was a big deal. It wasn't like today where there's just tons of capital sitting on the sidelines waiting to jump in. So back then, you couldn't do a loan easily that was more than 50 million. You had to club it with several sources. So getting the capital together was a much bigger challenge, which meant that obviously you were getting better pricing because it wasn't easy for many of the assets to trade in the market at that time. And the bigger the asset, the better the deal you got, because it was harder for, there were many fewer people who could do it. Whereas today, the bigger the asset, it seems like the more there's a lot of eager participants who would like to get a chunk of capital committed to that asset. So, you know, it's a very different, you know, the market's matured and grown up, and it's not the same market that it was when I joined Sam in the late 80s and into the early 90s.
I'm always fascinated. I mean, you said two things in our last few minutes that are really interesting. You know, one was the idea that banks were going to provide loans to on real estate, you know, with the deregulation. And the other was, I think you alluded to the fact that, you know, the fund that you and Sam had was perhaps one of the first opportunity funds that existed. And this is just in the early 80s. And here we are in 2024. And as you said, the markets evolve so much. How do you kind of think about, you know, looking back on your career, how do you think about like the different stages of the evolution of the market? Were there clear demarcations when you knew that, you know, hey, real estate or private equity is going to become not just a niche asset class, but an alternative asset class, and you could see capital flowing in and out?
Well, I don't think there are, you know, specific dates. I think it's been a continuum. And, you know, when you started out, you know, you had insurance company and bank lenders. That's what you had. And mostly private owners, not private equity firms, but private owners, mostly family owners. And it was, you know, you bought a property and you got a loan. And back in those days, the loans were very high leverage. I mean, you know, they went well up into the capital stack before experience led to different types of loan to value ratios. But then we started to move into, you know, the capital markets, and the first programs were those commercial paper programs that were then rated and were, no, they weren't rated. They were backed by letters of credit from banks. And then they were hedged to the extent that people were trying to curate, they were swapped if they were trying to create a fixed rate financing. The whole CMBS market really got developed because of the collapse of the SNLs in the early 80s. And in many ways, the RTC drove creation of the CMBS market. So that was the first time you had securitized commercial real estate debt. Then the REIT market, which had been around, but had been a little niche thing, when owners were trying to figure out how to recapitalize their portfolios in the aftermath of all the carnage of the 80s, you know, there was, you know, obviously the biggest challenge was the tax issue, because before the UPREITs, if you contributed to the REIT, you had a taxable gain immediately. So the family owners weren't able to do that. But then when Taubman did the first UPREIT and it worked, then lots of people started to look at the UPREIT as a way to liquefy their real estate but not have a tax bill, so that they wouldn't have a taxable event they couldn't afford to pay the tax on. So that was really the creation of the REITs. And, you know, Sam very early on wanted to do lots of REITs. And so the first one we took public was MHC, now ELS. And we took it public. Sam and I were co-chairman, and I was the CEO of that. And we broke some new ice there. Sam had a great t-shirt of a picture of him strangling somebody saying, for the last time, it's not called a trailer, because we were trying to get people to call it manufactured housing, not trailer parks. And once we got their attention and explained how these assets performed and how they had performed and what housing need they served and what a modern community looked like, by the time we got to the actual offering, we were oversubscribed, I think it was 8-1. So, and to Sam's credit, he did not go outside the price range that had been quoted as part of the offering of the deal, because he wanted people to do well and he wanted to create a market. And so, everybody who bought into that did very well in the aftermarket initially, because it turned out that once people understood it, it was pricing much more firmly than it would have otherwise. And then he followed with equity residential, and we looked at taking the retail public, but decided since you had several very large regional mall REITs already in existence, like General Growth and Simon and DeBartolo and Taubman, and that it was better in his case to monetize by selling to those existing vehicles. And then the last one was Equity Office, which he took public actually slightly after I had left. I had originally been the chairman and CEO of Equity Office, but I left, and then they took it public. It's probably like 18 months later. And at the time, you know, it was one of the largest REITs in the market. So the REIT market came along. And meanwhile, the opportunity funds morphed into other vehicles. They became broadly private equity shops. They started, you know, offering value add funds, began offering geographic funds, and began offering a variety of things. There had been obviously institutional advisors before that, but they'd either been core funds or they had been separate accounts, had been most of what they were. The diversity of products that started to get created really started to, happen in the 90s. So, but what's happened is effectively real estate's gone much more mainstream. It's much more of an efficient market than it used to be. There's much more capital available. And all this is consistent with other industries and other sectors of the economy. It's not that real estate is different. It's just that real estate has matured. And as a result, I think when you look at how do you create alpha, you have to either believe you can just buy better than other people, or you have to believe you read cycles better than other people, or you have to believe you operate real estate better than other people, or that you're better off at sector rotation than other people. There are, different ways to differentiate yourself, but it's not like in the 80s when just having capital was already a differentiator. So things have definitely matured and grown up quite a bit from those earlier days.
You mentioned it took 4 years for Sam to convince you to join him as a principal from the banking side, and then you left. What made you desire to go out on your own to start Transwestern Investment Management at the time?
Well, fundamentally, Sam's a smart guy. He was pushing the right buttons. He said, don't you want to be the client? Don't you want to be the one making the decisions? And as an investment banker, it was exciting being part of all those deals and being the intermediary. But there were times when you would have made a different decision than your client made. And sometimes it was even contrary to advice you were giving. And so you felt it'd be nice if I could both, have a point of view and eat my own cooking. And that was something that I did find increasingly appealing, but it's actually for a negative reason that it came to a head. Bob Lurie, Sam's original partner, wonderful man, very smart, was diagnosed with cancer. And Sam decided he had to bring in somebody on his corporate side of his world, which ended up being Rod Daymire. And he needed to bring in somebody on the real estate side to be the partners running the two sides of the shop. Since Bob was terminally ill. And so that's really what brought it to a head. He said, I've had fun having these discussions, and we'll still do business together as you as the investment banker, but I need to fill this position and I'd like you to do it. But if you won't, let me know and I'm going to need to go find somebody else. And, I looked in the mirror and I decided at that point, after getting to know him over a longer period of time, I'd grown even more impressed by his approach to how to invest. And so I decided I would make the jump. Because I was happy at Goldman. It wasn't that I was happy being an investment banker. And in fact, I'd been happy being a lawyer. But this just sounded, just as Goldman was doing more exciting things than I was doing, it seemed even more exciting to be a principal. And, I'll give you a quick story. I'd been there only about 2 weeks, and Sam's office and my office were next to each other. And he walked in, and this is going to show how long ago it was, I was, looking at handwritten spreadsheets that had been given to me and looking at a deal in Texas that we were trying to decide whether to buy. And Sam walked in and said, what are you working on? I said, well, we have this office building we can buy in Austin, Texas. And he said, describe it to him. I did. And it was not a big deal. It was like a $14 million deal. And he said, so how much will you have to write a check for as you're part of the GP? And I gave him a number, and he starts laughing. And I said, well, what's so funny? He said, well, a couple months ago when you were my investment banker, you would tell me, well, I would do this with that $100 million, and I would do that with this $100 million. You were very quick to give me advice about what to do with my money, but now you're looking at a stupid little $14 million deal where you're going to write a small check and you're agonizing over whether to do it. And I said, well, I want to make sure I make a good decision here. And he says, it's different when you write a check, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it is different when you write a check. And that was his point, was that, you know, so I always tell our partners and tell our people, you know, we're using live ammunition. I mean, this is something where you're going to live with the consequences of what you do, but you still have to be able to make a decision. So, and we bought the deal and it worked out just fine and, you know, all the rest. But that was my first deal when I joined him, where I was supposed to either bless it or not bless it. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't used to being in that position as compared to being the advisor. And I had no trouble giving him advice when I was the advisor. So
I love that. Advice is cheap, right? You gotta, you know, put your money where your mouth is. No way to learn it other than to do it. So it sounds like you had an incredible run with Sam. How did the next chapter begin? What prompted you to, you know, separate and or start, you know, go off on your own to start Transwestern?
Well, you know, I think, you know, the biggest change was when I joined him at the end of 89, the world was very challenging, including the existing portfolio as well as all the new stuff. And I found that very stimulating, that we were all day long bouncing back and forth. And when we got to 94, you know, we'd gotten some things public and we were getting liquid again and things were getting better. I found that Sam was not engaging as much on the decision making. And I found that that didn't work as well for me. I liked when we went through things and made decisions. And I got to the point where I tried to leave a year earlier than I did. I went and sat down with him and I said, I really, you know, I've learned so much. I'm so appreciative, but I'd like to go create my own shop and, you know, and do this where I'm, you know, I'm the principal instead of working for the principal, because, you know, I was a partner, but there were very different levels in that partnership. There was Sam and then everybody else was well below. And, you know, he encouraged me to stay. He was going to try to give me some areas where I'd have more autonomy on certain things, because I found as we got bigger and bigger, there was more and more bureaucracy in some of the ways we did things. And so I agreed to stay. And that was the year I tried to buy Rockefeller Center, which he had dreamt of owning. But at the end of the day, you know, we did not get that deal done. We got our $14 million breakup fee, but we didn't get the deal done. And then we also started, you know, a parking activity. We started a water rights activity. Ultimately, though, at the end of the year, Steve Quazzo, who had come from Goldman Sachs after, you know, I had recruited Steve to Goldman Chicago out of Goldman New York. When I left, he'd been recruited over to Zelle, and his only condition had been that I'd not leave again without first talking about it. So, and we sat and talked about it, and we decided that, you know, if we were going to do our own thing, it was a good time in our career to do it. And so I went back in and I sat down with Sam again a year later. And this time I'll always remember, because it really is a Samism. Sam looked at me and he said, if I were me working for me, I wouldn't work for me either. And that was his blessing to go do it. And he asked that I stay until the current fundraise on that Zelle Merrill Lynch fund was completed, which I did. And then he was always very supportive after that. He was a strong reference for us at any time anybody wanted to check us out, and was very supportive of us. And then I, you know, until a year ago, I would have breakfast with him a couple times a year, maybe three times a year. It was always great catching up with him. And, you know, it's too bad that he's not with us anymore. So
amazing. Out of curiosity, Rockefeller Center, are you able to share what didn't work out for that deal other than you didn't end up with it?
Well, as you may or may not know, Goldman Sachs had an inside track because they had made a financing to the REIT. And there had been, it was owned, if you remember, it was at that point owned by a Japanese owner. And we had worked out a structure to bring new capital in and to pay off Goldman and to keep the Japanese in. And the leadership of the Japanese company decided on the night before the bankruptcy court hearing that they were not going to move forward. And so at that point, the business was sold to a joint venture of Goldman with Tishman Speyer and the Crown family. So, you know, it was a competitive process and we did not end up with the property. So, you know, I think Sam was always good about the fact that there was something he was willing to pay. And beyond that, he wasn't willing to go. I mean, he had a very strong internal sense of what something was worth to him. And I've tried to bring that to our group that it's not a matter of bidding and then convincing yourself each time, can you pay more? You start off with what's it worth. And obviously, you may leave yourself some room in your initial proposal, but you're not going to go beyond a certain point when you've decided what it's inherently worth, intrinsically worth. And he was a master at that. He would decide this is what it's worth. And that was where, you know, you could come up with structures that would make it worth more, you know, seller financing, you know, a tax structure that solved tax issues, could be an earnout, you know, could be deferred takedown on an asset that isn't matured yet. I mean, there could be a variety of structuring solutions that would get him to a different number. But if it was a straight cash purchase, you know, he would have a sense of what that, you know, what that was worth to him. So
you left Sam with his blessing and over to, did you start Transwestern or did you join Transwestern and then build it up? And I guess I'm curious, how did being the real principal or the top of the stack, if you will, in the partnership, how did that, you know, your experience maybe, you know, compare? Yeah.
Transwestern, at the time it was called Transwestern Property Company. It was a company founded by Robert Duncan, who had been a Trammell Crowe partner. And they were a partner of ours at Zelle on a number of assets. And they were looking for a way to become more active on the capital side. And Steve and I were looking for an operating platform that we could leverage off of as we bought assets. And so we looked at a variety of alternatives. We had a number of options that we could have pursued. And we chose the Transwestern option because we thought that both their capabilities and the markets they were in were going to generate the most immediate opportunities and that we could grow it from there. We liked the people, very good people. And so Steve and I teamed up where basically we became equal owners with the founder in the property company, and he became an equal owner with us, and the three of us owned the investment company. And then all of us would dilute for other partners in the two different structures. And so it was a startup. We got office space in Chicago and we, you know, began hiring people and funding deficits because initially we didn't have enough of an asset base. We were very fortunate that one of our longstanding relationships, Northwestern Mutual, wanted to immediately do a fund, but they wanted to be the only partner in the fund. But that worked out. We did a fund structure with them on an office recovery play, primarily focused on Texas, which worked out well. We also had a number of deals we did with Baupost. They were a really good partner for quick decisions and the rest. And then subsequently raised our first discretionary capital broadly raised fund. And that became our primary vehicle for new activity. And that was, you know, that was when the markets were still, you know, this is 2005, 6. The markets were still sloppy. There were still a lot of things out there that you could buy at a price that, it wasn't 2000, it was 1995 and 96. So decades are beginning to blend, 95 and 96. And so we, you know, we still were finding a lot of things that were good opportunities. And then it was in 2001 and 2 when it seemed the markets had pretty much healed and there wasn't nearly the distress in real estate that there had been. And Transwestern's operating capability had expanded through third-party management to manage a lot of very large institutional assets for other people. A lot of the large institutional names that you'd be familiar with were clients of the firm. And so the firm loved doing that and wanted to do more of that. And I just, buying million square foot office buildings for me was, it was not, in my view, where we were going to find the most alpha. So I went in a different direction in terms of creating Green Court. So, but they've done very well afterwards. So, you know, that's, you know, kudos to them. There are a lot of ways to be successful in the industry. And I've enjoyed, you know, being more niche oriented in terms of the strategies we've been able to execute on.
So. Well, that's a great segue. So tell us a little bit about Green Court. You know, when did you start it and why? You know, I think it was the search for alpha or the belief in generating alpha, but, you know, why the sectors that you're focused on and kind of what opportunity did you see? And, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, Green Court as a company today.
Well, you know, initially, the main premise initially was find sectors where it's mostly family owners, mom and pop owners, where there's not established large players, or at least not large established third-party managers who have full capability. Also, where aggregating assets creates value because institutions would like to invest in the space, but either the REITs that existed were too small for them to put a lot of capital to work, or they didn't want to buy small individual assets because the aggregation created value just because you assembled something that an institutional investor could invest in and scale once you assembled it. And, you know, initially, first strategy was the manufactured housing, which was a continuation of when I was with Sam. It was MHC, became Equity Lifestyle. At Transwestern, we created Hometown America, which was sold subsequently to the state of Washington, who still owns it today. It's one of the largest private platforms in manufactured housing. And so starting it at Green Court was sort of my third round of creating a business in that space. We found that, you know, there still was a lot of direct sale opportunities with owners. We knew a lot of the owners through the state associations and through the National Trade Association, and were able to, you know, sit down with people and consummate transactions relatively efficiently. We were paying your prices they were excited about, but we were bringing some scale benefits that we were going to be able to apply to the portfolio that they didn't have. And so that was the first one that we really got off the ground. Initially, then we also started off by focusing on urban street retail, which was a strategy we did for about 5 years before we decided that the internet was even hitting these operators more heavily than we thought they would. So we actually liquidated back out of that strategy. And then the next strategy became the near airport parking, which for us is a covered land play. We like owning large tracts of land next to the airports. But there, the key thing was we bought a couple assets, but we really needed a platform. We needed an operator. And we thought, as early as 2004, we thought we might be able to buy an interest, not a controlling interest, but an interest in one of the platforms. That didn't happen. And then we had the opportunity in 2011 to buy the parking spot, which we thought was the premier platform. I think Penny Pritzker and Marty Nesbitt and Kevin Schreier had built a really great business there. They had brought a level of hospitality and a level of professionalism to the space that had not existed before. So that was not a ground-up startup. We inherited a very good platform and were able to then build on that. Next strategy was the senior space. We wanted something that we could, you know, build without dealing with a lot of government reimbursement or with a lot of acuity, a lot of healthcare in the platform. So we focused on the independent living and the active adult. Baby boomers are aging, but they're aging more slowly than previous generations. They're staying active longer. And so they are finding the active adult, which does not include the meals or the housekeeping, they're finding that very attractive. And then when they move into the independent living, they tend to do it, you know, more at age 80, you know, than in the old days, it was at a younger age. So that business has shifted, but the demographic is that the fastest growing population over the next 10 years is going to be the over 65 age group. So, you know, that has been another business. We built an operating platform there that is called True Connection Communities. And then the newest one for us has been the industrial outdoor storage, which to us, again, is a covered land play. Ultimately, there'll be a higher and better use, but in the short term, with logistics doing what they're doing, particularly for truck storage, there's a need for places to store the trucks between weekly runs. And we very much like that business. It's a business, again, that we think we have to build scale in order to achieve, you know, the alpha that we'd like to achieve in that space. But over the years, you know, back in my Zell days, I did a lot of office, a lot of regional malls, a lot of apartments. In my Transwestern days, we did a lot of warehouse distribution, a lot of flex space. I've never done a lot of hotels. We did some at Zell involuntarily, came with other things. And so I don't have a lot of experience with the hotel space, but they've always struck me as being, you know, again, a place where having operating capability is a good thing, particularly reservation strength. And over the years, I've had a chance to play in a lot of different sectors. And so we're always doing white papers on new sectors. We're always thinking through new sectors. You know, fortunately, a couple we looked hard at, we didn't do, because a couple of them haven't done as well. And a couple that we looked at, we maybe should have jumped into. So, I mean, it's like everything else, but you can't spend a lot of time looking backward. So we're focused on what's there today and what's available today and what makes sense and where are the, you know, where are the macro trends going in terms of where there's going to be a need. Because Sam used to, once again, have a philosophy that real estate is the tail on the dog. The dog is the economy and the way people use space. And the tail is real estate. It satisfies the needs of the dog. And so he used to be a big believer that, you know, you need to figure out where is the demand in the broader economy for space. And then that's likely to be a place you ought to be spending some time looking at. So so I think we start by trying to figure out what the macro trends, where do we think things are going? You know, as an example, one of the things that people have been anticipating has been autonomous vehicles. And we believe that is coming. We never thought it was going to come as fast as some people thought, you know, 10 years ago. So I just still think that's coming and that's going to change a lot of things, but it's not going to come as fast as people thought it was going to come.
For our listeners, you've used the term covered land play a few times. Can you explain what that is for those who aren't familiar?
Well, it's finding a piece of land that you believe over time is going to have a much higher use than what it's currently being used for. But the current use produces an attractive yield that you can earn while you're waiting for the ultimate higher use. And covered part is that you have income that will service debt and that will pay you a yield while you're waiting. The land play is that you believe that the land is in a location where land's going to become more valuable and more scarce and be driven by demand of new uses that are higher than the uses than what you're currently using it for.
So as you think about these niche sectors, you know, you mentioned kind of two things. One, you know, businesses that were owned maybe by mom and pops, and two, where, you know, you benefit from scale. It wasn't that long ago, at least in my recollection, that manufactured housing, industrial outdoor storage, seniors living, parking, like these were things that were not necessarily on the radar of institutional investors yet. I believe the business that you built is a business that is, you know, capitalized with institutional capital. How do you think about this transformation from a capital allocation perspective for these niche sectors to become, I think you called them alternatives today, or even, you know, dare I say, mainstream in some cases? Like what has happened that enables
this? Well, let's take manufactured housing, because I think it's the most dramatic example. the manufactured housing deals we're doing today are fundamentally different than the deals we were doing 20, 25 years ago. 20, 25 years ago, we were buying fully occupied assets that were probably priced below market because the private owner was happy doing what they did every year, but you know, they were happy with the yield they were getting on their basis. They weren't professional real estate people. Often they were contractors or they were farmers, and they had taken a piece of land. Contractor used their crews off season to build out infrastructure for the next phase. And the farmer looked at the land as being something that wasn't productive enough for them for their use, but they could be used for housing. And they viewed the land almost as being free. And they would build out, you know, 20 sites a year or 30 sites a year. And that's how most of those got built back in those days. And you'd buy a fully occupied, you know, community. And the opportunity might be that now it was 30 years old and you need to replace some of the older homes with new homes, but it was a relatively light value add proposition. The value again was that you had institutional capital. Your cost of capital was cheaper than other local players competing for that asset. And you had scale benefits in terms of insurance and in terms of you bought your homes cheaper, you were able to finance the homes better, you had certain scale advantages that other people didn't have. Fast forward to today, most of what we're doing today is redevelopment. Because if it's full and it's, you know, stabilized, you know, there didn't used to be a brokerage community that found this interesting enough to specialize in it. Now there is a brokerage community that finds it interesting enough to specialize in it. And there are a variety of institutional players who will buy, particularly if they're in portfolios, will buy stabilized manufactured housing communities. So what we're now in the business of is fixing assets that then will be assets that those people will want to buy. So, you know, when we buy a community that, you know, we've bought one that we had to replace the entire sewer system on because it was out of compliance with the EPA, where 20% of the sites were vacant because when the homes got foreclosed on back in the 90s, when there was the financial crisis and the lending to the space, the owner never, they were used to the dealer bringing in the home and filling the site for them. And they never set up a home sale operation to fill those sites. You know, there was, you know, tired amenities, the clubhouses need to be spruced up or maybe expanded. But a lot of it comes down to now the sale, the home sale operation, because the dealer network that used to sell the vast majority of the homes, and they would reserve lots in the communities. And so Mr. Smith would come in, I want to buy that home. And they'd say, okay, I've got three communities where reserved lots. Go look at them. Tell me which community you want me to deliver the home to. I'll set it. And you can live in a home there. And the dealer network got decimated back in the 90s. It's never been fully rebuilt. And now most manufactured community owners run their own sales operations. So they're buying the homes directly from the factory. They're bringing them in. They're setting them. And then they're selling them to the end user, or they're even renting to the renter because there's now a significant rental activity within the space, which also became much more possible when the GSEs decided they would start financing communities that had rental homes in them, which historically they didn't want to do. And that changed, you know, a dozen years ago. So there've been a lot of these changes, but the strategy now is that we're buying assets that you typically need something done to them. And it may take us 4, 5, 6 years to do whatever it is that needs to be done. Or if there's an expansion, we'll price it based on our ability to build the expansion and fill it. And we'll obviously want a higher return for that. But everything we're doing in that space now is very much value add. Particularly if it's a Florida senior trophy community with a golf course, which we bought a lot of those in the old days, you're going to have a line of people lined up trying to buy that. And it's going to be a the competition of who's willing to go how low on the cap rates. And we don't spend any of our time in any of those processes because we can't generate any alpha. We can't generate a return for our investors that justifies the investment. So that's really an example of how an industry that used to be very mom and pop. And by the way, a lot of the assets that are trading still are mom and pop assets, but now they have a very active brokerage community soliciting those listings and presenting them and packaging them and all the rest. So, you know, they get it out to a wide circle of interested parties. And if it's a trophy asset that's full, it'll trade at a good price and it should. I mean, those assets are very good assets. They'll perform very well. And if your cost of capital or your target return is, you know, more of a core type of return, you'll be happy. It'll be a good investment. But if it's supposed to be in a value add pocket, you can't get value add returns on those kinds of opportunities.
So Greencourt today is in four main businesses. You mentioned, you know, near airport parking, manufactured housing, seniors housing, and industrial outdoor storage. What's the size and scale of the company in terms of employees, any kind of like operating metrics that you know you can share to help us orient?
Well, you know, the answer to that is that in the Chicago headquarters, there are about 60 people. In the Florida office, there are another 50 people there. And then there's a couple smaller offices, Dallas and Denver. But in the field, there are quite a few people. I mean, the parking business alone is a couple thousand people. And, you know, it's labor intensive. You're running shuttles. You're running a retail type of operation, interfacing with the customer. And even though we've invested a lot of money in technology to make, you know, the person can do everything they want to do with us through the app, including tracking where the shuttles are and, you know, making the reservations and, you know, scanning with their QR code in and out of the property, not having to deal with anybody. All that stuff is possible, but it still is a lot of people. I mean, we have fewer people per customer than we used to have, but we still have a fair number of people. And in the senior housing space, there's a lot of service. I mean, particularly in the independent living, because you're providing meals, you're providing housekeeping, you're providing activities. And so the staffing in each of those properties will be, you know, from somewhere from 25 to 40 or 50 people, depending on the size of the property. And so, you know, there'd be another 400 or 500 people there. And then the manufactured housing is going to tend to have a sales operation and a management operation at every property, plus a maintenance operation. And so, and mostly set up, we outsource to third-party vendors that we oversee, so we're not running full-time setup crews that we have as employees. But, you know, across everything, it's probably about 3,000 people. And I think, as is true of most businesses, much of your success is based upon the recruiting the right people and providing the right opportunities and the right training. And I think, you know, that is a very important part of Alpha, is having businesses that people are excited to be part of.
So on that, you know, in terms of, you mentioned you spend a lot of your time, or the firm spends a lot of time thinking about trends and writing white papers. You briefly mentioned autonomous vehicles. Are there other kind of trends that you see or that you're tracking that you see coming that might dramatically impact the way that people use space and thus the value of the real estate or the underlying land?
Well, I think the one that, you know, the one that is the biggest challenge that everybody's facing is the affordable housing issue. You know, how do we provide housing at a price point? And on the one hand, part of the solution is to more broadly provide zoning that allows manufactured product, which is much less expensive per foot because it's built on an assembly line, you know, in a controlled environment and everything else, without the kind of customization that you'll get with a site-built house. But part of the answer also is, you know, potentially, you know, we spent a lot of time looking at co-living, and, you know, we're just not sure in the post-COVID environment that people are as excited about living in a more dense environment. But I do think one of the solutions to affordable housing is, you know, more shared central space and more limited personal space. And that way the total usage square foot per person goes down dramatically. And whether or not that ends up being, you know, micro units or that ends up being truly co-living shared units, I don't know. But that's another way to take high cost locations and to bring down the cost. But fundamentally, there's some bigger issues we need to do. One is that, you know, a lot of our building codes are very, very rigid and very outdated in terms of new methods of construction. And, you know, just if you look at just the challenges Mass Timber's had in terms of getting accepted market by market. And so a lot of what we could do also is to fundamentally take a hard look at changing some of those. But there are constituencies in every one of those provisions who currently make their living doing it the way it's done. And so trying to change those is politically challenging. We also, you know, we have a, you know, we do have a strong NIMBY streak in this country across many communities, across almost every community. So the idea of opening up more locations to provide, you know, an affordable product is a challenge. We also, from the point of view of when we build things, the number of mandates and the number of impact fees that we're putting on new development, if all the incremental cost of infrastructure is going to be placed on new development and none of it's spread across the broader community, then you're inherently making the incremental product much more expensive. And then you drive the price point for the middle higher. You create a bigger population now that needs a subsidized form of housing. And so our housing policy is, you know, as a country is pretty convoluted. And if we're going to be serious about fixing it, there are a number of things we're going to have to do. But I think in terms of products, you know, we've been intrigued by, you know, some of the build-to-rent products. You know, some of them are, you know, more dense, one-level living in locations where that can get zoned, and you can deliver that at a price point that makes more sense than the standalone site built. There are, you know, there are modular solutions here. So if you don't want to go with manufactured, but you want to go with modular, but modular then runs into the problem that modular then in most states and most localities has to then be built to that local zoning code. And so you lose a lot of the efficiency of mass production. So if we could, and a few states have done this, if we can get more of a standardized modular code by state, which would preempt local building code, we can bring down the cost of some of that. But, you know, you have to, you know, you're going to have to tackle some sacred cows to get there. But I think if we're talking about the largest unmet need, if you go back to Sam's dog, the biggest unmet need in society today is housing. It's not retail. Some might think it's data centers today, but we're going to run up against big energy issues with the data centers. Some might think it's some other product, you know, but, you know, take apartments. Most of the apartments that are getting built are on the higher end, and that still is good for the market because there is a shifting of demand. When people move to the upper end, there's a shift that creates more B apartment and more affordable apartment availability down the chain, but it's not a perfect solution. So I think housing is one we spend a lot of time talking about. If we had a great solution, we'd be doing it. We have not found the great solution, and I know a lot of people in the industry are debating this and structuring attempts at nibbling away at this, but I don't think anybody's made a big dent. And, you know, if you listen to the Peter Linneman stuff as an example, the unmet housing need just keeps growing. We're not even chipping away at it. It's actually growing. So,
yeah, absolutely. These are massive issues. I think just to segue to the last part that I want to spend a little bit of time on, you spent a lot of time in your career investing, building businesses. And I know that, you know, we first met I think back when you were the chairman of ULI, the Urban Land Institute, and you spent a lot more time recently kind of giving back, mentoring. I'm curious, what advice do you have for people who are in the business today or younger people who are looking to get into the business, you know, based on what you've learned throughout your career?
Well, some of this is going to sound a little bit like a commercial for ULI, but the great thing about ULI is that because it's the big tent and everybody's there and you can both participate at the district level, so you can start locally and then you can move nationally, or if you want to move internationally, you can move there as well. But what you want when you're younger is more education, and you want networking. I think the networking and education when you're younger is really important. Meet a lot of people, get to know them, learn what they're doing, get involved in a product council so you can learn more deeply what's going on in a space. You know, be intellectually really curious, which is just something I get bored easily. So I like the stimulation of new things all the time. That's why you mentioned pre this event that, you know, you were interested in why the Technology Real Estate Council. Well, I had been approached as I finished my term of as chairman. We had an unmet need for 10 more councils, and they wanted 10 of us that had run councils to start new councils because they want experienced leadership to lead the councils. And I said, well, I'll do it on one condition, and that is that you let me create a Technology Real Estate Council. And, you know, I guess, you know, being just the most recent past chairman, you have a little bit of pull. And so they said, sure, you know, we'll let you do that. You know, well, by the way, what is a Technology Real Estate Council? So, and, you know, initially a lot of it was focused on prop tech, but a lot of it also, it's just broadly the interface of, you know, real estate and technology, which real estate is one of the least impacted by technology of all the industries. And that's not necessarily a good thing. That's one of the reasons why our productivity as an industry is pretty flat for 50 years in terms of being able to produce real estate. So for me, it was a fun idea. I'm excited that there now are, you know, two flights and then maybe a third one soon. It seems to have resonated. I was particularly pleased that both the current chairman at that time and two other former chairs decided they wanted to be on the Technology Real Estate Council. So it was a good group. But we also went out and we recruited people out of the venture capital firms. We've recruited people out of the prop tech side of major real estate players. We brought in some government officials who would have a perspective from their side about what they think can get approved and not approved. We brought in some attorneys, not many, some architects who are dealing with how to design buildings in today's world. So it's been a very rich group of 50 people in each of these councils debating how are these things going to play out. You know, I find that stuff very interesting. But career-wise, I think, you know, every step of your career, you're learning more than you think you are. And I would say that don't underestimate how much you are learning and learn it. And then that's part of your permanent human capital. You know that now. And that's something that you'll find leverage in unexpected moments in your career as you move forward. And I still think even with the maturation of real estate, there are more interesting, fun people in real estate than in any other industry. And so getting involved with groups of people in real estate and learning from them and having a chance to, you know, engage with them in both formal and informal settings is just a good use of your time. Now, you've still got to get things done. You can't just spend all your time going to industry events. But I think there's a blend there that's important. And I would, you know, I would say similarly, the Real Estate Roundtable, if you're younger and your firm is a member, those working group committees that are below the roundtable are really where policy positions are being developed on behalf of the industry. So if you're interested in environmental issues, you should be involved there. If you're interested in capital market issues, you should be there. I mean, there are a number of ways you can get connected to some interesting discussions that are going on. So, but just you get up every day and realize the world changed overnight and see what you can learn today. I mean, that's really, you know, what I try to tell our own people. But I really enjoy, there's a lot of bright young people coming into this industry, and I really do enjoy working with them. And I found that one of my more fun experiences was I did teach for a semester at Wisconsin's real estate program. And you realize that by the questions you get asked, you first go, is that really a good question? And they start thinking about it. And you start going, yeah, actually, that's a pretty damn good question. I just never thought about it that way. And so the stimulation of getting challenged by younger people on something, it makes you recalibrate and even think over some of the things you thought you already knew. Because once again, every night the world changes. So
sure does. And I couldn't agree more that, you know, across a lot of industries, there's a lot of incredible people, but the folks that I've met, yourself included, are, you know, ultimately what keeps a special attachment to the real estate industry.
I've had no regrets about, you know, this is the industry I committed to. It's been a great industry.
Well, Randy, we could go on for days. I find, you know, the story and the lessons and experiences you've had fascinating, but we're out of time for today. So thank you so very much for joining me and sharing some of your story with our listeners. And I look forward to the next time we get to chat.
Look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter at B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.